And the guys who are producing, they're just producing phenomenal numbers. So even though gold business is one of the hardest businesses in the world, and there's always operating challenges, when you get $2,400 gold and, you know, $30+ silver, companies are starting to make a lot of money.
Ravi, how are you?
Fantastic, Andy.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining me today. It's really interesting, and I wanted to get your 30,000 foot view here of really what's going on. Really, and I think it's, instead of a conversation about gold, it's a conversation about money, if you would. And what I mean by that, it seems like every currency is, it's almost a race to the bottom, if you would, right now. And gold has really started to take off, I want to say, in the past 4 to 6 months, really in October. That was a low-ish, but now it's really started to really heat up, and silver's just running. So long story short, precious metals are very strong here. It just seems, what is your perspective on why it seems different in the strength that it has right now?
I think that's the question. So what's changed just now? All the arguments that you'll have people like me chatting about their views on gold and why gold has gone up, why it should go up a lot more. All those facts were in place. So all those trends were in place for the last many years. What's different now?
Right.
And I keep asking myself that very same question. And I go back to a couple things. And you mentioned a discussion of money as opposed to a discussion specifically of gold. But, the truth is they're inexorably intertwined. And people born in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and more recently, don't have the same connection or the concept of gold as money. But, we do have to realize that we have centuries or even millennia of history where gold and the concept of money are intertwined. And I look back, we're looking at very long-term trends here and thinking, what's changed now? Well, I go back to seminal moment, invasion of Ukraine in 2022. What does that have to do with money? I think that's, history, we're going to look back, whether it's 5 years from now or 25 years from now, we'll say that was a very important moment. And why is that? That was the seizure, forfeiture, cancellation of Russian assets overseas, specifically US dollar denominated assets. And that was always there in the fine print. We all knew it. And it was something that had to have haunted policymakers and administrators and leaders in Japan, China, and certainly Russia and places like Iran, where they feel very much at risk of retribution or action from the United States. But it was buried in the fine print. It was like, if we're going to live on a US dollar denominated global monetary system, then presumably they're going to play by the rules, and they're going to want that to continue to be the case. And the fact that they surprised us all, I think everybody was surprised, people who are follow these things closely, with what transpired in Q1 of 2022 with the cancellation of that money, almost by definition, showing that it wasn't truly money if it could be canceled by a foreign sovereign. And so I know that's not very recent. That doesn't fall into the window of gold's recent move, but in the longer time frame and the context that we're looking at, that was a turning point and a seminal moment. What's happened in the last 4 to 6 months, like since we've seen this big sprint in gold, I think maybe, and just letting our minds wander here, it's time that those who had otherwise had interest in preventing gold from moving either cannot prevent it from moving anymore, or they're okay with it moving. And why would they be okay with it moving now, whereas they wouldn't have been okay, or for whatever reason, they weren't okay a year ago or 10 years ago? Perhaps we're now setting the stage for something more dramatic in terms of a monetary adjustment, or I'll even use the word reset. And this is a preface to that. That's the day. I can't point to anything specific about that. On a more micro level, I also point, I like to use the energy equivalence argument. And another moment that we'll probably look back at, probably not 5 years from now, but 25 years from now, again, looking at these very long time horizons. And that is the convertibility of the renminbi into gold, and the use of the renminbi to purchase energy, specifically oil. And money, like everything else in the world, follows the laws of physics, and it follows the path of least resistance. And if money's worth more over here than it is over here, it's going to flow downhill and it's going to go to where it's most valued. And right now, or for the last several months, last several years, we've had that movement of gold money to the east, where it's worth more energy. And that has not stopped. If anything, that's accelerated. And we see that the physical premiums in the Chinese market, if you go back and translate the energy equivalence of that gold, what's it worth in joules of energy, you're going to get more for that money in the East than you are in the West. And so money's obeying the laws of physics. So again, all of those arguments would have been valid 6 months ago, and maybe even 3 or 4 years ago. But I think we'll look back in the future and say, with the benefit of hindsight, those were two really important moments, and those came together and started, finally the dam broke at some point at the end of 2023 or early 2024.
Okay, so I know where to start, but that's a lot, and it's a lot of very stimulating, in things. I was really surprised that you started with the Russian-Ukraine war, and I'm glad that you did. Can we pull on that a little bit more? Cancellation of money. Talk to me about that. And I say this rhetorically to me, but for the sake of our listeners, what happened?
So, two things. I'll talk about what happened, and I'll talk about how that was interpreted by foreign leaders. So, yes. First of all, what happened? Russia has had moved the vast amounts of money out of U.S. dollars, out of U.S. treasuries, out of U.S. denominated assets. But the world we live in, and being an exporter of energy, they still had a huge amount of U.S. dollar denominated assets. Now, the way most people who are not familiar with how money moves around the world aren't familiar with the stranglehold the U.S. government has over the use of the dollar. Every transaction has to flow through a money center bank in the United States. That way, whether you're Indonesia now selling oil to Japan, which has traditionally occurred in dollars, notwithstanding the fact that neither country is a dollar denominated country, that transaction happens in dollars. That money does, in a virtual sense, flow through the United States. And if it doesn't flow through the United States, it ain't happening. So the United States has this vice-like grip over the use of the dollar, the world's de facto reserve currency. And they basically canceled, for all intents and purposes, seized Russian dollar-denominated assets and had complete ability to do so. No other country has this kind of control over even their own currency. Russia could have had renminbi sitting overseas. They could have had euros, and those governments, respective governments, wouldn't have had the same kind of control or ability to seize those assets. So that was a seminal moment. And all of us, everybody wants to, human nature is, if something has happened in the past, and if it has happened for a very long period of time, it's most likely to continue happening. That's how our brains work. Yeah. That's how we're biologically wired. Newtonian mechanics, bodies in motion tend to stay in motion, bodies at rest tend to stay at rest.
Right.
And for a very long time, everything's been just fine. So the U.S. has had this power, but they only use it against real bad guys. And I'm saying that in air quotes and somewhat facetiously. People perceived by the U.S. government or painted by the U.S. government as the real bad guys. And nobody's much minded if North Korea has been severely sanctioned or Belarus. The fact that hundreds of billions of dollars of assets were forfeited or seized, that, everybody took notice on that one. That was a big nut. And that forced policymakers, decision makers in countries, specifically China, to accelerate anything that they're thinking, anything that they're worried about or concerned about. All that just went into hyperdrive as of the time of that seizure post-invasion of Ukraine, because that meant, hey, we do something with Taiwan, or we're perceived as doing something with Taiwan or somebody else that the United States doesn't like, there go our U.S. treasuries.
So
and
if
that was always
in
the back of their mind, but it just became so much more real at that point.
Why then, and why China?
With China, I think it's something that was for sure always in the back of decision making. And, you know, why would you get yourself in this position? Having such a huge stockpile of U.S. treasuries, of U.S. dollars, effectively, how could you not? So you're running a huge trade surplus.
Yeah.
You're selling more than you're importing. You're running a surplus, and you're running up the bank account. And so very hard not to, with what's transpired with their economy
over
the last several decades. It's almost like an 80s reference again, Brewster's Millions. How the heck do they get rid of all those dollars? So as many resource deals as possible, structuring loans into developing economies, basically pushing out, getting rid of dollars and getting back hard assets. Or hard obligations in return. But it's like they couldn't do it fast enough.
Yeah.
And so now, post February 2022 and that invasion, and that seminal moment in terms of the treatment of U.S. dollars as money, or the question mark now hovering over the truth or the reality of U.S. dollars as money, all those, whatever plan B, C, D, and E, they're all, you know, gone into hyperdrive. So that took a while to percolate through the system. And I think we just started the effects of that translate into prices on our screens with respect to precious metals.
Well, okay. So interesting. Let me go then. Back, I want to say 10 years, Shanghai.
They open up an exchange, a metals exchange.
Is that now starting to hit as far as trading
and as far as being priced? And
meaning it was always priced in the COMEX and the London Exchange. That is shifting now. Correct me if I'm wrong and walk me through that. That is shifting to China and Shanghai. Am I right on that, or am I wrong on that?
Absolutely. And these are things that for that to have an effect and have critical mass, to have a real impact, it's taken time. It didn't happen overnight. And you layer in the fact that you can now have physical delivery and trading of gold in renminbi in China for delivery
that's
in China.
Crazy.
And you lay into that also the settlement of oil purchases in renminbi and convertible into gold. And you start to stack up the volume and get to that critical mass.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm fond of paraphrasing Hemingway. It happened, you know, how did it happen? Very slowly at first and then all of a sudden. So while it may seem like, well, what happened in the last 6 months, it's really a number of factors that have sort of come together. And finally, you know, it was the straw that broke the camel's back, and you broke all sorts of technical levels. And I go back to my earlier statements, maybe those who would otherwise have stopped such a breakout either no longer have the ability to do so, or it's in their minds, it's time to just let it go.
Okay. So, my mind is spinning. Number one, the second thing is like, okay, so oil now is being traded, I don't want to say default, but it's traded in gold. That has severe implications, not only for the price of gold, but for the price, but also in U.S. influence and power, no?
Absolutely. And these are all long, jagged lines that trace back to deals done to basically remove the United States from the gold standard, and between the United States and the government of Saudi Arabia, which were, of course, very well understood and have been in place for 50 years, for oil to be traded in U.S. dollars. And that, you know, we all have to remember, maybe it's not as intuitive as one would think. If you volume weighted the average transaction that's happening around the world today in terms of dollar value, the average transaction that's happening is the purchase of energy, oil, gasoline, diesel, natural gas, whatever it is. That's the largest volume of transactions that happen on a daily basis, on an annual basis in the world. And so the fact that dollars have always been required to purchase energy, and okay, sure, copper, nickel, other things trade in dollars too, but they're all peanuts, they're just nothing compared to the global energy market. The fact that you had the largest, for a long time, the largest energy exporter, Saudi Arabia, you know, agreeing to only export that energy in for payment in dollars and effectively recycle those dollars to the U.S. Treasury market, that set the whole world on the course where the U.S. dollar was, in fact, the world reserve currency for all intents and purposes. And it worked. And again, they go back to that system. People born in the 70s, 80s, 90s, or more recently, you never seen anything but that. So right. Why, and it's worked. So why wouldn't it keep working? Well, it's going to work until it doesn't work. And it's starting to look like it's getting closer to breaking.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So what does this mean for U.S.-Saudi relations then, or even in a broader scale? I guess that's what you're seeing with OPEC, OPEC Plus being a lot more I don't want to say compliant, but non-following the U.S. lead.
Yeah. And we're all, you know, the customer's always right. So for decades, the largest customer, the largest energy importer was the United States of America through a combination of factors, not the least of which its own success domestically in producing its own energy. That's no longer the case. It's growth of economies elsewhere and shrinking reliance on foreign energy in the United States. Those two things intersecting, customers always right. Your biggest customers are now no longer the United States. And you're going to have to start to bend to their will. And you're starting to look out 5 and 10 and 15 years. Those things aren't going back to the way they were. They're actually accelerating in the other direction, away from the way they were. And that's what's changed. So if the United States went back to being by far the dominant energy importer, and they were much more reliant and tied on the U.S. economy for their prosperity, and that was still where the pull of the access of power was, okay, we could hang on to the system for longer. That's not the case. The opposite of all those things is the case. And that's all contributing to this move from west to east.
So it's really about emerging economies like China and India really now becoming the strength that they are, and them importing, if you would, Saudi and OPEC oil. Now that's where the power is shifting then, is that's what you're saying.
The customer is always right. And so those are the customers now, and they're likely to be the customers for the next many years. And they have a different agenda. They're fundamentally disadvantaged by the U.S. dollar-based global system.
Sure.
And they're much better off with a different system. I don't know exactly what that system is going to look like. I don't know if they do. And they probably, several stakeholders have conflicting interests there as well. There's maybe no obvious solution to that. But it's definitely true that everyone is disadvantaged to the U.S. dollar-based system, and there's going to be a continued move away from that. And it's the underlying driver is energy purchases.
Okay. So I laugh because it's like I can see, not out of humor, but almost out of nervousness, but also I can see, as you said, the dots. If you would, if you look back 20, 30 years, well, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, with the U.S. getting off a gold-backed currency. Now, let me ask you this. If we can project then, what do you see this leading to, if you would? What are the dots pointing to? And again, that's tricky because we don't really know. Well, really, we don't know, not theoretically. But what do you see happening? What's in the spectrum, if you would, of reasonable outcomes?
So, again, like the more we zoom in, the harder it becomes. The further we zoom out, the more we can put our, you know, pause, pontificate, and put our thinking caps on and say, well, what's the big picture here and where are we headed? Maybe don't know how long it's going to take to get there or exactly how we're going to get there, but where are we headed? From a monetary perspective, I look at the world having an otherwise, I'll use the mathematical term. An intractable problem. And what is that intractable problem? without unprecedented growth rates, which would require some sort of massive demographic boom or massive productivity boom. And, you know, beyond anything that we've seen historically, you have Europe, the Western United States, Canada as well, and Japan. They're the bulk of the world's economies in this intractable debt problem. We've got hundreds of years of history, thousands of years of history. Every currency other than gold has ultimately gone to zero in terms of purchasing power. That's historical fact. There is no currency we can point to that was around 500 years ago that's not currently worthless. So that is an overarching trend for sure. Are we going to see the governments of Europe, European Central Bank, the Federal Reserve in the United States, Japanese Central Bank, are they going to default on their obligations? I think we could assume this is highly unlikely. But then how are we going to get out of this intractable debt problem? So the answer is inflation. And inflation you can get for a bunch of good reasons. And you can also get it fundamentally through debasement of the currency in which your debt's denominated in. And this is, if I go back to a historical analog, this is the Roman emperors shaving the precious metal content off their coins of the issue, right? The treasury's running low. Okay, we've got to put less gold in the coins. Eventually it's copper, and then it's less copper, and then it's nothing. And then it's pieces of paper and ultimately digital book entries. So that's, again, zooming way out, we've got this intractable debt problem. I can't foresee, of course it's possible, anything's possible, but I certainly wouldn't predict a U.S. government default. I would predict continued debasement of the U.S. dollar in real terms and continued debasement or deflation of the fixed dollar denominated debt. And euro denominated debt and yen denominated debt, and you're going to lose more and more purchasing power with those paper currencies, and we're going to come out of it. It's going to be extremely painful. It's really going to hit the middle class. Your 1% or your 0.1%, they benefit immensely because they're hard asset rich. They probably actually borrowed huge amounts of money, and the poor or below the poverty line hurt, but less affected because they don't have savings. They don't have cash. They also don't have assets to protect them or benefit in these inflationary kind of scenarios or debasement scenarios. But they're in a lousy position here, and they're slightly more lousy over here. Those who are really wiped out are the middle class and everybody else in between. And that's where your savings get wiped out. You're the more conservative person. You don't have a lot of borrowings. You have a lot of savings, you have a lot of cash. That's all getting debased as we speak day by day. And, you know, where do we see that? We see that in the prices of precious metals, cryptocurrencies, assets, which are, you know, in theory, inflation hedges, all performing extremely well. And that's telling the smoke alarm's beeping. That's telling us something's going on here. And we're seeing it at the grocery store. We're seeing it in other places. Our dollar's not going as far as it used to, and that's the exit path here. So, what does that mean to other things? It means a lot. It means it affects every financial asset, affects every asset on earth. And how do I protect myself in this scenario? If you believe in this zoom out and the premise that we have intractable debt problem, we got to deflate the debt through inflation and get our way out of this by hook or by crook. What does that mean for me? It means I need to own hard assets. So if I can own real estate, if I can own precious metals, maybe I'll throw cryptocurrencies in there. It's, you know, harder to put your finger on, but it's got to definitely be in the conversation. And hold on for the ride, because, you know, it's one of those turning points in history and the history of capital markets. This is a big deal, and it's really going to change people, families, countries, fortunes in the coming years.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think we are absolutely on a turning point. And I think that's, I think you put it best. When you zoom out, you can see it, if you would. And then just that would be my evidence. And then just anecdotally, just me going to the grocery store with things
so much
more expensive than I go shopping for eggs or bread or whatever. Now, listen, your experience, I'm very interested in the capital markets and the gold markets. You see a lot of things, and it's been such a tough time the last several years. I would say several years in the junior gold markets. What are you seeing now? Are you seeing anything change differently as we've had this decent run up, that decent, really good run up in the metals? Are these companies getting better access to capital and that sort of thing? If you could talk about that.
So the short answer is, of course, things are a little bit better, but has the worm really turned? I don't think that's clear yet. And why is that? There's a number of reasons. And I'll also have to sort of break out the Canadian or North American junior market, but in particular, Canada versus the Australian market. And I think you can see a few clear differences in terms of the Australian market performing a lot better and having better access to capital there, which is strange. Historically, go back decades, and I don't know how many Australian companies would come through my office, and the opening line would be, if only we were listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange, our shares would be so much higher and would, you know, life would be great. And now it's the reverse that we're hearing.
It's the reverse.
So what does it look like in the junior market? So first off, juniors have been a value creator for management teams historically. Over a long period of time, typically not great value creators for investors.
Right.
Why is that? It's got this sort of lottery type payout, realistically speaking, to junior mining and exploration. I mean, anything could be in the ground there. And those who are better at framing it and selling it tend to do better, not necessarily attached to the actual reality of what ends up being in the ground. But that asymmetric payout where you have the huge, huge winners and then, you know, 19 out of 20 are complete losers in the end, that's works against the sector. And, you know, it's always come back from that. That's always been true. And it's always come back. Again, human nature, we want those big winners. We want the excitement of making 100 times our money. And that is possible in junior mining. But it's been, you know, it's now feeling like in the distant past. So the last time I saw a really strong junior market was in the zeros.
Yep.
And before that, you have to go back to the early 90s. So it's sort of like moved beyond the mindset and the experience set of many investors. And I get giggles out of some people, particularly younger investors that I speak to when I talk about precious metals. And the thought bubble is like, how old is this guy? Like, we're getting these ideas. And again, it's, you know, human nature. We've seen phenomenal performance of wealth creation from tech stocks and other growth stocks, and just abysmal wealth creation from mining in general, but specifically junior mining. So that, you know, whenever you have a sector that's like sort of haunted with its own past, and you layer on that it's been such a long and painful bear market, there are hundreds of companies that are dead men walking, just absolutely flat out broke. And the next $1 million they raise is just to pay bills from the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you got this huge, you know, anvil sitting on the figurative head of this junior mining market. And you got to chisel your way. You restructure some of those payables. Maybe now your creditors will take stock because they see gold at $2,400. So, well, maybe I'm going to get out of this thing in the end anyways. Maybe you can raise some money, pay off some of that debt. And typically what you see is as that worm starts to turn is you start to see convertible debenture deals done on very favorable terms for investors. You also see we call in Canada special warrants where companies issue stock, but you also get a half or even a full warrant giving you a double dip to the upside. And you start to see these deals get done, and they're usually $500,000 or $1 million, so really tiny deals. It's a bottoming process. And we've had a few of these false starts over the last 10 years where you started to see that and then it didn't follow through. This time it's happening again and it feels a bit better to me. So, that's starting to happen. We're starting to clean up some of the messes. Some companies are restructuring, and the guys who are producing, they're just producing phenomenal numbers. So even though gold business is one of the hardest businesses in the world, and there's always operating challenges, when you get $2,400 gold and, you know, $30+ silver, companies are starting to make a lot of money. And because of the excesses and because of this anvil sitting on everybody's head, guys haven't blown it. You know, they haven't increased their exploration budgets, and in fact, they've cut them. And they haven't gone out and done a whole rash of acquisitions. There's been a few, and that's also part of the bottoming process. But you know, guys haven't lost their mind and gone off and started spending money like drunken sailors again. That hasn't happened. So, you know, it's turning into actually a high capital efficiency industry, which it just was not the case from ever. And one that's starting to accumulate retained earnings. Again, not the case ever in the past. And that's going to change the view of the sector. As you know, if we continue to see these prices, you're going to see generalists allocate more money. You're going to see pension funds and other large institutional investors start to allocate more money. It's just almost disappeared as an asset class. And any movement of money back into the asset class is going to have a profound effect. And we're going to start to see that cleanup. So my view is, famous last words, this time it's different. It's feeling like it's not going to be a false start. We're in the cleanup mode right now. We're not in the, things aren't flying. I've seen some juniors on my screen that are up in percentage terms, are up massively, but for the most part, they're still below where they were a year and 2 years ago. So for anybody who's been an investor for any period of time, it feels better, but still not good. But that cleanup, we're in that process. It's got the feeling that we can come out of it this time.
Yeah, that's good news. And it does seem like there was just a really massive, which really the industry needed, just a massive cleansing, if you would. And now if you're a value investor, which I am, but you say that, and are you really a value investor? There is, it does seem like there's tremendous value out there. Let's talk about your latest projects here. And I would listen to you recently. You really got into renewable energy. Talk to me about that, which I also find interesting too, because that is a complex, if you would, a complex industry. And I'm trying to figure that out, and I don't know really where to start. So talk to me about that.
So for me, it's a confluence of a number of interests. My background, I've spent the first half of my career in capital markets. As a fund manager, ultimately as a CEO of an investment firm. So definitely an understanding of how capital markets function, how to source capital. Also, in my case, a very strong focus on emerging markets and structuring opportunities and working through opportunities in places where maybe things are not so conventional as they would be in Western Europe or North America or more developed markets. And for me, renewables, we could see the writing on the wall. Things were changing. The first phase of renewables, and we're seeing that now with the hydrogen market, or what were the buzzword of hydrogen. Renewables didn't make sense economically on a standalone basis, and we constantly saw the comparison. Well, coal costs this much, and natural gas is here, and oil's here, and look how much of it we use, and renewables are so tiny, and you put up a solar park or you put up a wind park, and it doesn't even make money. They only make money because they get all sorts of subsidies from the government.
Right.
Every last part of what I just said was absolutely true.
That was me.
None of it is currently true. So what transpired? First of all, the technology, you had to build an ecosystem. Who's the first person to build a plant making solar panels, wind turbines? Who's going to figure out how to actually do this effectively and efficiently? And that ecosystem had to be built. If you didn't have government subsidies, which definitely led to people putting solar parks in places that are not even a little sunny, and wind parks in places that aren't even that windy.
Right.
If you didn't have those subsidies, which created those oddly perverse situations that continue to persist, you wouldn't have had an industry. But that happened. We had an industry. We went into what I call phase two, which is you're now putting solar parks where it's really sunny. You're now putting parks where it's really windy. and your benefit of 30 years of technological improvement and declining costs. So your efficiency is going up, your unit production costs are going down. And so the total cost of building renewables has plummeted and the efficiency has gone up. And we're now we're in this phase two where you don't need subsidies. And if you show me a very sunny location like the Mediterranean, even certainly parts of North America, the American Southwest would be an example, or California, where you have high energy prices and you have a great solar resource. You mean, you just can't compete with solar. You can install it in months, as a relatively small footprint. And it, once it's up and running, you have almost no operating costs. So phenomenally low cost. Same goes for wind, longer to install, more of a footprint. But once it's up there, you got decades of power at almost no operating costs. So in a windy location, coal can't compete. Even cheap coal and cheap gas can't compete in terms of generating electricity. So that's all things that have changed. And that trend has just continued and is going to, will continue in that direction. The third stage of this whole renewable thing is like, now, how do we unlock, now that we've done all that's called the obvious stuff, the low hanging fruit, how do we unlock the next level and take a really sunny location that's maybe isolated geographically from anybody who needs any electricity, or a really windy location in the same boat, windy place, don't need any power where it's windy, but I got all this great wind all the way over here. And that's where we're doing things with energy storage. We're building longer and more efficient transmission. And we're starting to evolve this new vector for transporting energy, which is hydrogen and ammonia. And they both have their pros and cons. They're not perfectly efficient. And again, if you put it, stack it up against fossil fuels economically just defeat everything. They have incredible energy density, relatively low extraction costs, relatively plentiful. And we have an amazing, truly global infrastructure to both move it around and to consume it. It's decades in the making and it works incredibly well. Hydrogen stacked up, it just doesn't stack up. So what's happening in hydrogen is what happened in renewables 30 years ago. Lots of subsidies, lots of governments supporting the creation of an ecosystem, lots of naysayers saying, yeah, but this doesn't make sense. We could just keep using gas. It would be cheaper. All true. And over time, we'll see that infrastructure improve, the costs go down, the efficiency go up. And at some point, 5 years from now or 25 years from now, it will be a really material part of the energy mix, and it's going to be part of it. So from my perspective, as someone who enjoys sourcing capital, structuring projects, and being the beneficiary of very long-term trends, that drove my interest in the sector. And that's what got me involved in a significant way starting about 15 years ago.
Got it. Yeah. I remember listening to an interview with, I think it was Steve Jobs or somebody that worked for Steve Jobs. Is you have to see the next curve. And the market doesn't really see at that moment, it doesn't see the next curve. You have to see it and jump to the next curve. It sounds like that's what you're attempting to do. So
yeah. And as I said, if the further you zoom in, the less I can predict, or less I even want to try to predict.
Sure.
The further we zoom out, the more comfortable I am with trying to understand what's the big picture trend and trying to do something about it.
Got it. Well, Ravi, I think we should end it there. If you could give us, somebody wants to do business with you or wants to do some research more about you and read about what you're doing, where would you direct them?
Well, I'm fairly anonymous, so the best way to
learn responsive, about me, but responsive
through my LinkedIn, and I am I do respond to everybody. So everybody who reaches out, I will get back to you, and you know, even if I'm absolutely in no way interested in what you're pitching, but I do respond to everybody, and I really enjoy contacting people. In fact, I will highlight my previous energy company. The largest transaction that we did, which resulted in 50% of our revenue and 50% of our profitability, and was really the value driver when we sold the company, was through a cold outreach from somebody on LinkedIn.
You're kidding. That's awesome. That is awesome. Well, Ravi, I could talk with you for hours. I really could. It's been very stimulating. I do appreciate you coming on, and I appreciate your point of view.
Anytime. Thank you, Andy.
Appreciate it. Have a good day.